The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
On News Talk.
Hello and you're very welcome along to the latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I'm your host Sinead Ryan. Coming up today, London's lost interiors. We take a look at a new book showcasing that city's former architecture. We'll look at Heated, a new RTE series on how households and communities are helping with climate change. Is it a good idea ever to have a wooden floor in a kitchen? We'll be getting the experts in. And Niamh Marr will be shopping for loft beds, not just for kids, but for adults too. If you'd like to get involved in our show and get in touch with us, you can do so by email at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over on social medias at SineadRyan100. And of course, you can check us out on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you normally get your podcasts from. Now, are we all a little bit nervous this weekend? It's the final few days before we learn who will be the next leader of the free world. I'm a bit anxious like most people, and I think I'm with the vast majority, certainly in Ireland and probably Europe, when I say sincerely that I hope the good citizens of the United States tick the box for Kamala Harris so we don't have to witness another 4 years of an increasingly despotic sounding Donald Trump. So I wonder, is the White House even big enough for his ego at this stage? I'm really hoping we don't have to find out. So if you're on tenterhooks too, take the next hour to relax, think about nice things. We're going to help you do it and we are going to enjoy what's coming up. Lovely selection of guests and I am delighted to have your company. You're welcome along. Now, from palaces to cathedrals, townhouses to terraces, London is a city of magnificent and very interesting buildings. There's great diversity to the architecture there. And sometimes we can forget that a lot of it, of course, was destroyed during the World Wars, particularly World War II, leaving behind a very thin legacy in some cases for us to build that history on. So what did these lost properties look like, and have some styles been completely lost to time? More importantly, what has been preserved? Stephen Brindle is a historian with Historic England and author of London, Lost Interiors, and joins me now. Stephen, you're very welcome to the Home Show.
Sinead, thank you very much. It's lovely to be talking to you.
Now, this must have seemed like a daunting project from the outside. What did you want to focus on with this very comprehensive and big book?
Well, Sinead, there have been books in the past which have looked at lost London in old photographs, but they've always tended to do it from the outside, so old street scenes and lost buildings. And I realised that actually we have wonderful resources of photographs of historic interiors, of domestic interiors in particular, and I realised you could do a whole equivalent to these about the lost homes, lost domestic interiors of London, which would have a whole different aspect because it would take people into social history and into lots of styles of interior design, of interior decoration too.
So when you're looking at these houses, of course, anybody who visits London, and Irish people visit it very regularly, you see these absolutely gorgeous houses, these beautiful places around Mayfair and Knightsbridge and the palaces and all of that. But of course, all we're seeing is the outside of it in most cases. And interiors have changed so much. I mean, you go back to Victorian times or Edwardian times, you wouldn't dream of decorating a modern house like that nowadays. So have most of these interiors, apart from maybe the very grand houses, been lost to time?
Well, it's like this, Sinead. About half of the houses featured in the book have gone, the whole building's gone. Quite a lot were indeed bombed in the war. But even when the houses still stand, the interiors have almost always been stripped out. It's like people ripping out their kitchens every 10 or 20 years. It's partly to do with the turn of fashion, but it's also because a great many of these houses are now in other uses. They're like offices or hotels or other kinds of business. And the interiors have just been stripped out to reflect that change in use.
And of course, interiors give us a fantastic insight into how people lived and the kind of things they wanted to show off about. Because when it comes to decorating your house, you know, in some periods of design, it was about minimalism, how little you have and showcasing expensive stuff. And in other cases, it was about, I'm thinking of the Victorians here, with clutter, clutter, clutter. Everything had fringes, everything had little statues on every single surface. And to some extent, you can kind of get a real kind of look behind society with those interiors.
The feeling I get, Sinead, is that in the past, people used their houses, their interiors. I think particularly this applies to women who were really in control of households and the way they were decorated, as self-expression to a much greater extent than we might realise and that we do now, rather alongside fashion, because they didn't have social media. They didn't have any of the digital means of sort of expressing ourselves. And for them, alongside fashion, their homes were the stages on which they presented themselves, you know, to their own households and to societies. And I think interior design is really an important art form and a very personal art form, because it's one which most people, to some extent, can participate in and say something about themselves through their homes. And what people say in the past is this huge range of things. And styles become like a kind of language to express yourself in. And there's a whole range of historic styles which people used in the past to express themselves, say things about themselves. And I think to a large extent, this has vanished from our culture.
Now, in the book, you feature not just the great and grand houses, although there's plenty of those, but also a look at the middle class. And this was something that emerged maybe between the wars, would that be fair to say, when kind of, especially when women went into the workplace while men were away fighting and they suddenly maybe acquired money or a new way of living or a new purpose in life. And there's a lot here from kind of the early 20th century up, really up to the mid, you know, the showcasing even the mid-century styles. How did the middle classes want to reflect through their interiors how they lived?
Well, Sinead, the First World War is a huge divide here culturally, the sort of before the war and after it. And in the Victorian age, middle-class households in London might still have 5, 6, up to 10 servants, and their homes had just that cluttered quality you were talking about. For the Victorian age, profusion and richness and different fabrics and quite dark palettes of colour were what they wanted, and it must have kept the maids very busy. After the First World War, there's this huge generational change, as you say, and people react against the Victorian clutter. But the era, stylistically, is not just about the modern movement and Art Deco. There's a whole range of styles in interior design there, which have effectively vanished, and which we wanted to bring back in the book, some of that variety and richness. But this culture was very much controlled by women, and in particular in the interwar period, because several of the leading designers and decorators were women, people like Sybil Colfax and Siri Maugham.
Indeed. Now, it's extraordinary the extent to which empire fed into interior design throughout British history. And at its height, maybe the Victorian or Edwardian periods, there was a mishmash of people returning from maybe the grand tour, colonisation of other countries. And that was reflected in the artefacts they brought back. But not only that, how they designed entire rooms around that.
Yeah, absolutely. So much of art history across the whole of Europe, across much of the world, is about the way people interact with other cultures. And this is reflected in the book, in the interiors we see in several different ways. In the 18th century, wealthy British and Irish people went to Italy, they bought works of art, and they created built houses to house those collections. In the late 19th century, there was intense admiration for French culture, for French decorative art, and lots of super rich people collected fine French furniture, and they made French style interiors, many of which were actually made by French decorators to house them in. But there's another whole strand, which has really completely disappeared now, of what you might call Oriental interiors in London. We used one on the cover of the book, which is an ordinary terrace house on the outside, but inside it was turned into a sort of Arabic or Moorish fantasy interior, but by a soldier in this case, by a Major Wallace, who I don't know much about, but he'd probably been out east, and his house was turned, well, you look at the pictures and you might be in Cairo or Damascus, and it's the furniture and all the furnishing fabrics, as well as a little balcony overlooking room, the tented roof ceilings to the rooms. And there were several others like that. The Victorians were fascinated by other cultures, and a lot of these were done to a very high standard, and I think quite often involving Indian or Middle Eastern craftsmen.
Yes, and we had on, I think it was last year, we had on Lady Carnarvon on the show, and she was talking about a book she'd written about the seasons in Highclere Castle, which is Downton Abbey, most people would know that as. And she was talking about her husband's ancestor, Lord Carnarvon, who discovered Tutankhamun's tomb. And they have rooms filled with Egyptian artefacts. So that went on quite a lot when English people travelled.
Yes, indeed. We have interiors which were built around collections. The people like the South African diamond and gold magnate Julius Verner. He built a room for his collections of medieval and Renaissance works of art. Other people remodeled their houses to house collections of old master paintings. And there are all these people who collected, as it might be, Chinese and Japanese porcelain and made rooms which were designed to showcase those as well. So the collecting of works of art and the creating of fine interiors do very much go together, yes.
What are some of the more unusual houses that you featured in your book, Stephen?
Oh my, where would one start? Well, I was particularly delighted to find a picture of a nursery at number 145 Piccadilly, because that is where the Duke and Duchess of York were living.
Elizabeth Bowes Lyon, yes, before she became Elizabeth the Queen Mother.
And the nursery in question was what was the one which had just been made for our late Queen when she was Princess Elizabeth. And there's her high chair and her doll and her teddy bear.
So that right.
was, finding that was quite a sort of jaw-dropping moment. And I was really delighted to find pictures of Cecil Beaton's first flat when he lived. He had a flat on Rutland Gate, near Hyde Park. Cecil didn't have too much money then, but he was already being invited out. He was already a big success in society. And he had this floral wallpaper in his dressing room. And so he decorated it with a sort of decoupage. He cut out pictures of his high society friends. And so there were pictures of people like Tallulah Bankhead and Greta Garbo and these sort of debutante-type figures, and people like the Duke of Kent, Prince George, all of whom he knew in society. And he stuck them on the wallpaper on his dressing table. And that's where he also put his society invitations.
Oh, that's such a hoot. So, I mean, that is, first of all, creative, also a little bit spooky. But I'm sure they probably enjoyed seeing themselves. You'd made it if you were on Cecil Beaton's wall, was that it?
Yeah, absolutely. and he was photographing them at the same time, of course, and establishing his career as a photographer, but also a very talented theatre designer. He had a multifaceted talent. And in that era, in the 1920s and 30s, to get on in society, you didn't necessarily need a lot of money, but if you were talented and if you were funny and entertaining, you could really scale the social heights. And Cecil really did in his life. And that's what his apartment says. There's this sort of gentle, slightly camp sensibility to it. There's a lot of paper flowers.
And there were
flowers in the middle of the floor. I'm not sure how permanent part of the installation they were, but it's really sweet.
Oh, it's lovely finding photographs of that, because there's no way that could have survived all this time. Now, if you could bring back, one of those houses, one of those interiors, which one do you think you would like to see again in real life, Stephen?
Oh, gosh, Sinead. Well, there are lots of really wonderful, charismatic interiors, but I think that one stands out, and that was Dorchester House, which was on Park Lane, and its site is now occupied by the Dorchester Hotel. And it was one of these cases where a very rich man who never had to work, he was a moderately wealthy landowner who then inherited a really huge fortune from an uncle. He was called Robert Stainer Holford. And this sort of English choir built a colossal Roman palace on Park Lane. It was probably the grandest private house that's ever been built in London, called Dorchester House. There was a previous house on the site. He knocked it down. He built this palace. And he took his time over the interiors because it was his great pleasure. And it had a sensational marble staircase in the middle. And then there was a whole series of staterooms. And you sense that he took about 15, 20 years to decorate it because he was lavishing care on every single detail with his probably long-suffering architects and designers. It was an amazing house. If it still stood, it would be one of the great sights of London, but it didn't, and it went in 1928. So I'd say Dorchester House with its collections, please.
Send you back in time. All right. Well, look, Stephen, there's tons of stuff of interest here. It is the most gorgeous coffee table book, I'm going to say. You're probably not going to bring it to bed with you, but it is absolutely beautiful. It is called London Lost Interiors by Stephen Brindle, and it is out with Atlantic Publishing. It's in hardback, of course. Of course it is, because that's the only way you'd want to read it. It's retailing for about £50, so whatever that would be here. But my goodness, you're getting 650 of the most stunning photographs from the archives of historic England's houses, and they are absolutely beautiful. And of course, you yourself have worked as a historian with Historic England, and I know you're an expert on Brunel. Maybe that's for a different show. But Stephen, thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about that book on The Home Show.
Sinead, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Heated is a six-part series on RT1, taking a look at the implications of climate change at community levels. The show looks at the ways in which households and individuals can make practical changes to limit their impact on the environment. And one of its presenters, Ronan O'Dolly, joins me now on the line. Ronan, you're very welcome along to The Home Show. Tell us a little bit about what you're trying to get across with this series.
I guess there's two kind of big objectives, really. I mean, the first is obviously an educational piece. What we're trying to do is bring people in to not only the problems that exist when we talk about the climate, but also some of the ways that we can solve those problems. And I think it's more that wider piece of taking action and seeing examples of action being taken by incredible people all across Ireland. So that's very much the first thing, is that educational piece around explaining what the climate crisis is, showing what the problems are, and elevating people's awareness of the overall issue. So I think that's the first big objective. And then secondly, I mean, for me, I think, and probably more important, is raising the temperature, perhaps, on the climate crisis. And what I mean by that is, we are really in a profoundly challenging situation, the most profoundly challenging situation that probably humanity has ever faced. And the purpose of this program is not to give everybody all of the education, but it's to make it clear that this is going to have to be something that becomes a part of our everyday life. Mm. And it touches absolutely everything we do. It touches the entire economic model, the social model, the environmental model. This is not a silver bullet. There is no silver bullet. There is no one single solution. And what this program is very much about is explaining to people and showing people, hopefully, that across every single sector of the economy and society, we need to make transformative change. And these are some of the things we can do.
Indeed. Now, I was kind of buoyed when I watched it to see that it's not just all about kind of bashing us and giving out to people for what they're not doing and how everything's going to kind of hell in a handcart and all that. Because I think a lot of people are... they just get sick and tired of that message. Important though it is, it's just they constantly feel like they're being given out to. A lot of the stories in this series are positive. They're people who've actually made a change and maybe could inspire other people to do it.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I think if people at this stage, if people aren't consciously aware of how bad the problem is, there's very little more that can be done to try and spread that awareness. I mean, we have had article after article of the exponentially worsening situation. And there's no point in saying, oh, well, let's not be glum about it. That's not leadership, right? And that's not what those of us in positions of power or positions of leadership should be saying. It's not about being glum or bashing people over the head. It's about being real. Right. That's the first step in solving any problem, mm-hmm. is accepting how big the problem is. So for those of us who have accepted how big the problem is, the only question left is, what do we need to do to solve it? And that's where we need to now focus our efforts and attention. And I don't think it's necessarily up to everybody in society to fully understand all of the complexities of the challenge and fully solve all of the individual tiny things that they do every day. Because frankly, even if everybody started recycling and doing everything they could, it's not going to change things. And I think this, for me, is also about really refocusing hearts and minds. The idea of a carbon footprint was invented by BP, an oil company, and it was invented to distract us from where the big problem lies. And the big problem is at the heart of the economic model. We're producing too much, we're consuming too much, and that needs to change.
Indeed. And there has been so much buy-in and so many new entrepreneurs being created as a result of our new needs in society. And a lot of them are featured in this programme. I'm particularly interested in one, because obviously we're the home show, which was on a firm, I think they're called Habitat Restore, and they reutilise old, not old kitchens, but people who are changing their kitchens or bathrooms. They will come... Well, you tell us what they do, because I found that fascinating.
Well, this is a great initiative. And Habitat for Humanity is a North American charity. And they do have a presence in Ireland. They have six stores across the island of Ireland. And again, they're doing absolutely phenomenal work. What they do is they will come to your home and very safely and professionally and cleanly, they'll take out anything that you're getting rid of, large, bulky things. So if you're doing a bathroom renovation, if something is broken and you need to replace things, they will come and take out the kitchen. And what people will see is they come and take out a whole kitchen and resell it. And I think this is incredible for a bunch of reasons. You might argue, well, what's one kitchen? What's the impact of one kitchen being recycled going to have? But that's not the point. The point is how we consume and how we think about buying things needs to change. And there is so much stuff in the world that there is absolutely no reason to be buying new things every time we need something. And we need to move to a world where our first thought is, how can I get this secondhand? And that's not just good for the planet. When you do that, for example, with Habitat for Humanity and buying a kitchen from their Restore, your money is going towards an organization that has fantastic environmental policies. Typically, charities and social enterprise have more diverse employees, are more resilient, and invest all of the profits in good causes. So it's win-win across the board.
Indeed. And there was another couple of companies that I thought were absolutely fabulous. One was Grow Organic. Now, this is a company that's taking detritus, coffee grains, which God knows I have enough of in my house most days, and making fertilizer out of it. So it's getting a kind of a second run around with it. And then there was one which has been featured in the show coming up this week, which I've had a sneak peek at, called Grain for Lab. And they are making plastic, but biodegradable plastics, out of the byproducts of beer. Now, that's a bit random.
Yeah, well, again, this just shows the extent and breadth of things that are possible. And the thing I love about a lot of these stories is and for me, this is amazing, but I think it's actually something we talk about, right? This is a family who started Grow Organic, for example, and they've come up with an incredible solution and a very clever solution that's reusing not only the leftover coffee waste from your coffee, but also they've said, well, actually, we have a huge problem in Ireland with wool. We're producing a huge amount of wool and a lot of it's gone into landfill and farmers are losing out on the value of that. So what if we combine these things? So you have all of these incredible, innovative individuals. And for me, that's incredible. But it also suggests that the people with the least resources are potentially sometimes doing the most. Mm. And I think what this show does in a very, very good way, and this is something, you know, I'm not giving too much away by this, but it's almost easier for us to find stories from people who have less than it is for us to find incredible stories from the big corporations and multinationals who probably have a lot more of the responsibility to make change. And I hope what this program will do is not only inspire people in terms of what they can do at home, but also show that perhaps the energy and focus of where change needs to be coming from isn't right at the moment.
Well, Heated is on Tuesday at 7 p.m. on RTE1, and it's one of its three presenters, Rona Dolly. Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I presume it's up on the RTE player as well if people want to catch previous episodes, and they will learn, as I say, everything this week from finding seagrass farms under the water to the detritus from beer and how all of that is making a change. Ronan, thanks a million for joining us today on the show.
Carmela Margot.
Now, most of us love the idea of wooden floors in our house, but the expense and the work of maintaining them can put some people off. But that can be doubly the case, and double the worry maybe, when we're talking about kitchen floors. So should we go with wood in the kitchen? It's a beautiful material, but maybe not always the place for it. Well, Cian Mulvey, owner of Mulvey Stores, joins me now in studio. Cian, you're very welcome.
Thanks for having me, Sinead.
And you've just opened a new store.
Yeah, we have indeed. We've opened our second showroom now in Rathfarnham, in the village centre there. So we're excited to see how it goes. We've 220 floors on display and we keep stock going. So it's
220 floors.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. So it's trying to narrow that decision down is often what we're trying to facilitate for the consumer.
People have always loved wood, though, haven't they? I mean, it is the oldest and most natural of all floor types.
It is. And I think it's such a warm and nice product to walk on. It's lovely to, it's a lovely raw material that people have always worn too. So I think, yeah, people have always favoured in the home ahead of, say, stone and things like that.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to kitchens, we kind of avoid it because, you know, splashes and spills and the heat and the expansion and the contraction and all that kind of thing. And people traditionally go for tiles or laminate or that kind of weird one, which isn't for everybody, which are, is the tiles that look like wood.
Yes. Yeah,
but they don't really.
Yeah.
Well, maybe they do, but they don't really, you know.
The worst of both worlds, I think.
Do you think? Yeah, well, it is. They're not mad. I'm not mad about them. Now, I have seen some nice ideas of it. Mm. But the idea of wood in the floor. Do people ask for it? And if they do, what should they be thinking about for it?
Yeah, it's quite common, actually. We would do a lot of fitting of wooden floors in kitchens. I think what's important is to try and understand the pros and cons of the different product types that are available. So a lot of people will want to put real woods into the kitchen because of the look and the feel of them. But there's a couple of things you need to think about, really. One, obviously everybody thinks about water and water resistance and that side of it, which is important. And there are certain products that are better than others. But I will say nearly all the products between laminate, engineered and solid, they're all fine for spills. What you don't want to do is leave the water pooling for a long period of time. So we would say that depending on budget and lifestyles as well, this is something we would try and cover a lot with people in the showroom, is, you know, if you've a very busy lifestyle, very young kids, dogs, a lot of that side of things, your floor is going to wear down a lot faster in that space specifically ahead of others. Mm. So sometimes in that regard, a laminate or water-resistant laminate might be a safer option, but most people still tend to veer towards the real wood floors. Mm. And I think what we're always trying to get across to people is that you can have these products, but there are certain ones, as I say, that will wear better or last better, or at least letting the customer know what the life cycle is going to be like.
Mm.
So, you know, in a normal home with, say, a varnished or lacquered finish, you'll generally be looking at about, I would say, 8 to 10 years before it gets quite worn down. You just have to understand, especially around that triangle of the kind of sink, the cooker area, there's a lot more footfall in that one zone. So it's probably going to tire there a little quicker. That would be my thing.
Yeah, and I suppose what you want to avoid is having gone to the trouble and expense of putting down the wooden floor throughout your kitchen, which in a lot of cases nowadays are these big open plan areas, and having one area just looking tired and old and scratched compared to the other one. So are there certain woods that are better than others? And I'm thinking the hardwoods must be better. They are more expensive, but they would last longer.
They do. I think what you get with the hardwood floors, be it engineered or solid, you do tend to get, yes, it's a harder product. It also will have more life cycles in it. So what I mean by that is there's kind of two finishes you generally will get with real wood floors. One would be your lacquer or your varnish, and that's what we most commonly see. And that has the least kind of maintenance as you go along. The other finish you get is an oiled finish. Now, generally, I would tell people when they're looking at oils to be quite cautious in a kitchen because oil means maintenance, no matter what is said. It means that you're going to have to stay on top of it. Now, if you're the kind of person who is going to do that and will oil their furniture and will tend to look after things like that, great. But if you're the kind of person who has a busy lifestyle and won't be able to do that, that's the kind of floor that will age faster, even if it's solid or engineered. So it's about picking the right finish more than anything.
Okay, and I presume you can give advice on that based on the people's lifestyle. Now, if you are prepared to maintain it and you want that beautiful finish and you have the time to do that, what is involved in it? Do you have to sand it back every so often?
No. Well, with the lacquered finish, as I say, you'll probably get around 8 or 10 years before it starts to wear and look very tired. At that stage, you give the likes of ourselves a call. We'll come out, sand it, refinish it, and on it'll go again. And at that stage, if it's a white oak, you can really quite dramatically change the colour on it. And you could also switch over to the other finish now as well.
All right, so it's an option to kind of change up your floor.
Because
I see a lot of floors now, very kind of, bougie interior designers are painting the floors black or white or, all kinds of colours.
No, and that's quite common, and it's something we would do a lot of as well. Like, this is where sometimes people will think, going for a laminate, it's a better option. When you spend a little bit more on your product, you tend to get more life cycles out of it. So, as I say, every 10 years you sand it, refinish it, and you can kind of reinvent the colour and it looks brand new again.
So, without having to replace it.
Without having to replace it. And it's a lot less expensive than replacing it.
Okay. So there are options there, Cian. And what it means is then, of course, if you go with the wood floor, and part of that minding it might be putting down a runner or, putting that protective
Coat down. Yeah, a lot of people will. Now, as I say, with most of these floors, as long as you're with the lacquer, it's actually fairly impervious to staining and things like that until it gets very tired or raw. With the oiled finish, as long as you stay on top of the oiling is basically getting a tin of the maintenance oil, pouring it onto the floor and kind of rubbing it in with either a buffer, or you can do it by hand, but a buffer is easy.
So tell me what's on trend now at the moment. What are people going for? Because, I mean, I know that people love the idea of the wide planks, but also the kind of the herringbone, the really kind of hard stuff to look after.
To fit and look after. Yeah, well, we saw a lot from a colour perspective. We were definitely seeing a lot more of the kind of Scandinavian tones and the pales and pale and warms. We're now seeing a bit more of a push back from colour-wise towards the kind of more natural and even the smoke tones. They're getting a lot more attention now, which is lovely because they will warm up the space a lot better. As regards the herringbone is still incredibly popular, which is lovely, and it is a beautiful finish. And what we're probably seeing a lot more of now is people are mixing. So you might have one particular colour tone throughout the whole house, but then you'll have a mix of herringbone and plank match. So you can kind of make one of the spaces a little bit special with the herringbone.
All right.
Which is both cost effective and a nice.
Okay, and of course people can come and have a look at what you have showcased in your Rathfarnham Shopping Centre shop there, and have a look online. I presume you're online as well.
We are indeed.
Fantastic. Okay, Cian Mulvey, thank you very much for bringing us that and busting a bit of those myths about wooden floors in the kitchen. It's often our favourite time of the day, getting into bed after a stressful day, hopefully for a deep sleep. But if you visitors staying or the kids have friends over, then doubling up may just have to fit the bill. And did you know that bunk beds, often the favourite option, are not just for children? Niamh Maher has been taking a look at beds that do double the work and joins me now in studio. Very welcome, Niamh.
Thank you. Hello. Lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you back. Now, the bunk bed. I have had bunk beds over the years and very handy they were too.
Yeah.
Just the straightforward type. I didn't know there was any other type actually, to be honest.
This is it. It's such a throwback actually. Even thinking about bunk beds for this section threw me right back to my childhood. I actually had a cabin bed. Do you remember cabin beds?
Oh, they come up the high side.
Yeah, high side, and it had the drawers underneath. Oh, I felt so special when I had the cabin bed. I used to pull out the drawers underneath and have that, like, I basically made a little crawl space for myself. And I don't know why, for some reason, having the bed elevated a few feet off the ground made me feel very grown up. So it's a good thing we're talking about adult loft beds today. So don't gawp if you're an adult listening to this and thinking, I don't want to have a bunk bed in my house. I'm 30 odd years of age. But we're actually talking about wall beds and loft beds, and we're talking about utilizing the vertical space that you have in your rooms. And it was so interesting that you suggested this piece, Sinead, because I'm researching it at the moment because our in-laws come to stay and we have a three-bed home, and the double bed that's there in the room is great and it's perfect. And of course, if you have a spare bedroom, it's good to have a double bed, but we also double that room up as a home office. And so we're kind of walking around the double bed to get to the desk, and we were thinking it's just not a good use of physical foot space to have a double bed there that's not in use all the time.
Indeed. And even when it comes to bunk beds, it doesn't just mean there's a double bed. Of course, nowadays, it can mean there's only one bed.
Exactly.
But underneath it, you can have a desk, you can have a chair, you could have a sofa that pulls out into another. You end up with three sleeping areas.
Exactly.
There's a huge lot of choice out there. So let's get started.
Yeah.
Tell us what you have found. I love this first piece now, because this is what we would have traditionally called the Murphy bed.
Yes, the Murphy bed. So I didn't know that this had such a kind of a long lineage of history, the Murphy bed. But for some reason, it dips in and out of fashion. But actually, we've been doing some research on this, and wallbeds.ie is the website that we found. So they offer a full cycle of service from consultation right through to design to delivery and crucially installation as well, because it sounds like a lot. It sounds like a lot to get the measurements right and to get it bespoke to your own needs. So if you are in the market for this, what is essentially a Murphy bed, it's a bed that is hidden and then it folds out from the wall. And with wallbeds.ie, it also has lifetime guarantees on their specific mechanism. And it's also the only wall beds that are manufactured in Ireland as well. So
oh,
a really good one.
Okay.
Now, you're paying for the service, you're paying for the cost, and you're paying for that expertise that will come into your home and do this
do you
for
know what?
You.
Nobody's going to begrudge that, because the very last thing you want to happen is you're lying in the bed, you're fast asleep, and because your husband's brother stuck it on the wall, the whole thing swallows you up and whacks you against the wall.
Don't mess with the beds. Don't mess. Get the professionals in. Don't mess with the beds. So wallbeds.ie have sofa wall beds. They've got wall beds with desks on them. They've got straight wall beds which have plain doors. And there's a showroom as well if you're in Dublin on the Capa Road, so you can go out. Now, every weekend we say we're going out there and the baby's awake or it doesn't get there, but we're getting out to that showroom. So wallbeds.ie, expect me. Now, you're looking at, without any installation and stuff, you can look at kind of 700 to 800 and then upwards of. So you'll be adding more money onto it. But they do a free quote service on their website as well. And they can really, I think anyway, and what I'm hopeful for, blend it to your own needs.
Yeah. And the key to this, of course, is what you were saying earlier, that by day or when you don't need the bed, it's just kind of... It's like a panel sitting on your wall. There's no emphasis that it is a bed or that it'll drop down into anything bigger. So you can use it for office or den or playroom or anything else.
We're looking at having it as a desk, a wall bed with a desk on it, so that we can utilise the room as an office space. And then when we have visitors come over, we can transform it into a lovely double bed that still has shelving on the side and seamlessly blends in with the room.
Yeah, and it takes regular mattresses. Now, some of these, I know these Murphy beds, they don't have springs for it to come down, because just the way it's built, they'll have wooden slats.
Yes.
But having a mattress that's built for, that's, you know, proper size for it will get over all of that. Okay.
Absolutely.
So that's wallbeds.ie. Good. Good to have an Irish option there, and one
Absolutely.
That can be made for that kind of thing. Okay. What else do you have?
So looking to more of the loft bunk bed situations now. So going to Amazon, a now favourite of mine. So this is the Memphis loft bunk bed. 4'6", wooden high sleeper, they call it. It has solid natural pine, kind of a Scandi finish on it. It looks really nice. It's sold for easy home assembly. A lot of the ones that you're going to buy online, you are expected to assemble it at home. So just keep that in mind.
4'6". Now, that's a double bed.
Yeah, that's a wide one. And that's what I was specifically looking for. I was looking for ones because the second you search loft bed, you're faced with kids stuff. So I was really specifically looking for ones that would suit grown-ups. And I think you have to just change your way of thinking. We were talking about this before, Sinead, that like you would see a lot of loft beds in New York, in Paris, in London, even where space is tight and they want to really maximize that. For some reason, we don't utilize them as much here in Ireland. And actually, we shouldn't just automatically think that it's a kid's bed because they do come in sizes for double mattress. And then you can put whatever you want underneath it, a sofa, a desk, a chill space, a reading nook.
Yeah, it just doubles the space.
It literally doubles the space. So always look at that. So that one on Amazon was pretty good price. Now, it actually says it's not available at the moment. So I moved on to easyfurniture.ie and found a similar priced one that had seven left in stock. So this is the dark brown solid beech wood that comes lacquered, a beautiful dark wood colour that looks really grown
up. This is very stylish. Now, you wouldn't waste this on kids at all. No. This is, you don't want any markers or sticky fingers all over this.
Get
it's
away.
A beautiful bed.
No stickers on this one. 160 by 200 centimetres. So again, we're looking at a double bed here. It comes equipped with a safe fallout protection because that is one of the things. You're elevated when you're sleeping. And look, no judgment here. But if you move around a lot, maybe you need that extra layer of protection.
Well, something you don't have to worry about with the kids. With the adults, there may be a drink taken.
Well, this is it. You always have to think about that if you're on a ladder. So speaking of ladders, this one can be placed on either side during assembly, which is great because it has that universal appeal then for a variety of rooms. So if you're like, oh, well, which side would I be climbing up until, you know, it can go on either side. So you can adjust it to your own preferences as well.
Good.
And yeah, you're looking at about $575.90. And always, like you mentioned, just check on the mattress specs when you're getting these kind of loft beds
if
you're buying them online.
Okay, so that's easyfurniture.ie. That actually is a beautiful looking one.
Yes.
So that's very, very nice. Now, you did come across one a little bit cheaper, good old IKEA. Of course they have them.
Yes, well, I wanted to bring it down a little bit in price. I suppose IKEA is one of those places that I think is great almost for a bit of a stopgap, you know, see if you even like to be elevated when you're sleeping. So this one comes in at €339, 90 by 200. So like tight, single, I would say, maybe a teen bed, but it's definitely it's definitely not a kid's bed, but it's not a double bed. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
And it's the Vitfal range, apologies if I've pronounced that wrong, a loft bed frame, white, light grey. The details of this is what they say make it unique. You said it made it ugly, but I think that's kind of a preference.
I wouldn't be mad, yeah. I think it's a bit plain. It's a bit kind of industrial looking.
But listen,
who cares? It's your spare bed.
It's got the fabric guardrails as well. So if you're bouncing around in the thing, you're only going to hit your head off some nice fabric, so that's fine. It's got some yellow accents a la IKEA, and again a sturdy ladder that can go on either end of the bed as well. So I just wanted to showcase the range in that you can actually get one for under €400 if you want. And depending on the room that you have, again, this could just be for guests coming over. You want to have the option of giving somebody a place to sleep. It doesn't necessarily have to be for you, but it gives you that option. And I think we all just need to maybe look up and see what the possibilities are up there.
Look at the stars,
look
indeed,
the stars.
And you'll do it from the height of a double bunk bed. So lots and lots of options there. And of course, when you're looking at bunk beds, it is important to check the versatility of them, because it might be that you bought them for a kid when they were kind of 8 or 9, but it's rather than chuck it out and buy a new bed when they become a teenager.
Yeah.
If it has that facility to convert the bottom bed into a sofa or into, you know, a table and desk.
Or to take the bottom one out entirely,
yeah,
and have that extra space.
And have it underneath. That it's actually better value for money to do that at the beginning when you're not thinking of your kids as teenagers, and have that there for them in later life.
Definitely. And like, I remember me and my brother had bunk beds when we were kids, and then it got to a certain point when obviously we didn't want to be in the same room anymore because you're grown up. And I could never really figure out actually, Sinead, which was the better option, to be on the top bunk or to be on the bottom bunk.
Yeah,
but my brother used
to
kick the top of the bunk when he was angry at me. And I remember he used to get a few digs in the old back there. So yeah, good to think about that with
brothers
your kids.
Would always find a way, if you were on the bottom, he'd have found a way to tap you on the top of the head or something
or
like
that.
Or
if you're on the top, you'd find a way to chuck you off.
Exactly.
So it was actually always a negative no matter what side you were on. But yeah, I feel like bunk beds are very versatile, but they're not just for the young people in the family. I think they're a great space saver as you get older with loft beds. A lot of people, you actually see them being built, if you ever watch Grand Designs and things, people are utilising the space and actually building them inbuilt loft beds. And
you can
just building lofts.
Very, very cool ones for kids, which I've seen, that have a little slide Oh, that's so cool. You can come down instead of a ladder.
Oh, my nerves now. My daughter would be off that slide. So she hasn't really grabbed the concept of slides yet. So that would be a bit nerve wracking for me.
Not for long. They grow up very quickly.
Exactly.
All right. Niamh, well, thank you so much for doing that shopping for us.
Of course, anytime.
Super ideas there and really good, and not just for kids, as we say. Niamh Marr, Commercial Creative Director with thejournal.ie, and you can follow Niamh Marr on Instagram. And that's all we have on this latest episode of the Home Show podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you'd like to get in touch with us and maybe suggest a guest or a topic you'd like us to cover on the show, we would love to hear from you. You can email us at thehomeshow@newstalk.com. You'll find me over on X and Instagram at SineadRyan100, and I will chat to you there if you want. And don't forget, all of our episodes, all of our items are up on podcast, which you can find on the Newstalk app. Thanks to producer Aidan McKelvey, researcher was Rory Galvin, and Stephen McClune was on sound this week. We will get to do it all again next time, and hopefully, I'll be bringing you good news, and we'll all be in a better state of mind following that important American election. And sure, we'll be heading into our own not too long away. So I'll see you all next week on the next episode, and thank you for your company.
The Home Show with Sinead Ryan.
With Mila.
Saturday morning at 8. On News Talk.